So welcome to the CIO panel. Without further ado, I will turn things over to Susan Mitros. Susan.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. It's nice that nobody's come walking in with hurricanes in their hands, so it's a good sign. I hope you had a good evening last night in New Orleans. And we're going to start, since we have been, seems yesterday we time-stamped ourselves by songs. Does anyone remember Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers? Any Tom Petty or Heartbreakers? Oh, I got a few fans there. So if you remember the chorus of that song, it was Into the Great Wide Open. The song was Into the Great Wide Open, under the skies of blue, out of the great wide open, a rebel without a clue. So that's really apropos introduction to our panel, because our panel today is called Into the Great Wide Open, Leading and Managing IT in the Age of BYOD and the Clouds. So in IT, we're definitely into and out into the great wide open, but we have with us three rebels that actually are with a clue. So I'm going to introduce to you, next to me is James Hilton. James is Dean of Libraries and Vice Provost of Digital Educational Initiatives at the University of Michigan. And we have David Baird. And David is Vice President and Chief Information Officer at Wesleyan University. And Tracy Schroeder, right? And Tracy is Vice President of Information Services and Technology at Boston University. And we're going to discuss the role of senior leadership, especially as it relates to provisioning academic technology into the great wide open of higher education. So I'm going to start with Tracy. And Tracy, my question to you is, you've been at Boston University for almost 5 years now, and we're going to just cut to the chase here. So what's the real value of a CIO, and how does, as it relates to the academic side of the IT enterprise?
Okay, well, I think probably many of the folks in this room would answer to go get resources for academic IT, right?
Yeah.
Be the rainmaker. But I think we really need to take a step back a little bit and talk about the real question is, what's the value of the CIO to the academic mission of the institution? And that value, I think, should be working in extensive partnership and sort of co-creation of the future. Around what future learning models will be, what the trends in the technology space can enable, but that the CIO needs to be joined at the hip with the provost and the thought leaders of the institution academically, helping to chart that future. And resources for the academic side of IT support will flow from that, so long as that partnership is working well.
Good, good. You've been at Wesley now for, about a year and a half, right?
Yeah.
And so where in learning organizations where do learning organizations fall into the pecking order of your IT organization?
So in terms of the support for academic technology, I think is what you're asking about. Right, so it's critical. It's top of the line. And in fact, one of the things that I've been trying to do since I arrived at Wesleyan is look at what we're spending on IT everywhere across the institution with an eye towards moving as much of it as possible to the academic mission. So so that's kind of speaks to what Tracy was saying about how we want to really keep that first and foremost in our minds. So, and that takes a little while. You have to figure out where you're spending all your money in all the different places and then see where the economies of scale might be. So it's a process, but the end game is to try to devote as much to classroom technology and learning technology as we can.
And you can do that with the balance with all the other things that you resources?
No one said it was easy, but right. We're working on it.
Okay. So James, you're in a little bit of a different position. You are you used to be a CIO, uh-huh. And you recently left that position to become a dean of libraries.
Uh-huh.
So why do we need a CIO?
Dean of the libraries needs somebody to play with. I mean, actually, I'm serious about that. So, for example, when I look at some of the challenges that we face, like data management. So we know data management is going to be a growth industry. And one of the roles of the CIO is to think about how we approach academic technologies, how we approach all kinds of other, sometimes utility functions, sometimes strategic functions, but how do we start to approach them at scale? And, you know, the bottom line is data management strategies aren't going to work, at least at my university. We don't see them working unless the CIO, the library, and the vice president for research can't bring some momentum to it. Otherwise, it'll just sort of fritter away.
I had a CIO at one time, and he was famous for saying, nobody comes to a university because it has a great payroll system. But it seems like we put a lot of money and a lot of effort into our payroll systems and not enough and not as much effort into our educational technology tools and services. So, David, why should academic technologies compensate a CIO that focuses let me rephrase that. How should academic technology leaders compensate for a CIO that focuses primarily on the business side of the operation and not the academic side?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, and it took me a little while to sort of think about what I wanted to say about that. So I'll spin it this way. Maybe that's where the CIO should be focusing right at the moment. And the fact that they're not focusing on academic technology might be because the academic technologists are doing just fine without the CIO's interference, and he or she has you know, more work to do on the financial side. But I would say the next thing I would say is one thing that academic technologists can do is really put the stories of academic success out in front for the CIO to you know, share with cabinet, with the board, with others, and from those good stories that will reflect positively on the leadership and on the department as a whole, then things will flow. And then when they're ready to turn their attention towards academic technology, they'll be motivated to do so.
Mm-hmm. Either of you want to add to that?
The main thought I had, the phrasing of that question, how do we compensate for a CIO? Mm-hmm. Well, we shouldn't need to compensate. We need to shift the attention of the CIO mm-hmm. potentially, or the CIO's attention should be where the institution wants it to be. So if the CIO's attention is on ERP, it may be that ERP is on fire, or it may be that the CIO is not paying attention to the institutional priorities, in which case those need to be shifted. Mm-hmm. CIOs need to pay attention as much as everyone else to what the top priorities of the institution are. And if the academic technology leadership can help the CIO to see where the burning issues are, then that can be a service done.
Just curious in the audience, those of you who are in the academic technology side of your organization, how many of you feel that your CIO does give you the attention, not the resources, because we always can use more resources, gives you the attention that you think you need? Just raise your hand so I get an idea. Okay. And how many don't? What'd you say? About a little more say yes, and a little for those of our virtual audience out there, a little more say yes than no?
Yeah.
That's good. That's healthy. Well, it's interesting. A report came out at the beginning of the week, or maybe it was last week. It was ECAR's Today's Higher Education IT Workforce Report. And if you haven't read it, I think you please go read it. It's actually very, very interesting about the state of IT professionals in higher education right now. But there was a really interesting fact in there. It talked about salaries. And it said, across the industry, being an instructional designer will reduce an annual salary by $16,000 a year. It sort of showed a base salary, and if you were a CIO, your salary went up this much. If you're your PhD, it went up this much. If you were an instructional technologist, it went down $16,000. So I guess the question is there, and I'll give it toward Tracy, why is that, and how can you advocate for teaching and learning? Is that fair?
Well, first I'm taking guesses here as to why that is. But first off, my guess is there's some lag in those numbers. Mm-hmm. And that with all that's been happening in teaching and learning over the last 18 to 24 months, we're going to see some shifts there. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I think there are a couple of factors that come into play. One is that many other areas of the IT workforce, we're competing with corporate America to recruit those staff. And I'd say in the instructional design space and educational technology enablement space, there's less of that type of competitive force driving salaries up. Another piece is that I think sometimes instructional design is not well understood and may in some cases, even be seen in tension with the role of the faculty. Faculty should be doing this on their own. The instructional designer is taking over the role of the faculty. That may play into how highly valorized those positions are, and that creates some complexity in how do those salaries relate to faculty salaries, how do they relate to other IT salaries, and they're kind of in this middle space that's harder to benchmark and harder to work with from an HR perspective. But as far as the broader question of how to advocate for resources for academic technology, I think the strategy that I've used is tying it to service satisfaction as voiced by students and faculty, either through combination of actually as much data as possible, from survey feedback to benchmarks to anecdotal feedback, anything that can be pulled in to show that this isn't the vast majority of resistance I used to have gotten in the past around investments in educational technology have been, well, is this an if we build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. And we're going to persuade the faculty to, if I can show that the faculty and the students want this and are ready for it, I have a much better chance of success.
Okay. Well, we're going to do a speed round right now. And you have, in one breath, I'm going to ask you a question, you've got to answer one breath. Okay, so what keeps you up at night, and the professionally? James, we'll start with you. One breath.
Can we actually organize our activities across the whole of higher education to leverage and build a common platform that we're going to run the relationship between contents, activity, and learning analytics?
That was long.
Whoa, that was pretty good. Okay.
Mine will be easier. Security.
Okay. Keeps you.
Becoming Kodak.
Becoming Kodak. What do you mean?
Being on the inside of the industry and not being able to see or understand how disruptions outside are going to change the game, or not being able to get out beyond the constraints of the way that things are to create the future, and being left behind. Not that I think BU is in that mm-hmm. situation, but I think we as an industry mm-hmm. Are at risk for that.
Okay, good. There's been a trend to appoint a new position, a top senior leadership position, a learning technology position. So a top senior learning technology position reporting to the institution's top executive level parallel to the CIO. And a few examples, UC Berkeley, and you might be sitting in the audience here for all I know. UC Berkeley has appointed an associate CIO for academic engagement. Stanford has a vice provost for online learning. Cuyahoga has an associate vice president for e-learning and innovation. MIT has a director of digital learning. Notre Dame has a chief academic digital officer. Any of you in these new positions in the audience? Oh, I see one hand back there.
Two?
That's hard with the lights. Okay, yep, couple people in those with these new positions. These are top IT executive positions. They don't report to the CIO, they report directly to top leadership, whether it be president or provost. So we'll start with James here. In your view, what do you think about this new chief digital learning officer? You have a title that kind of aligns with this.
I was
going
to say, I'm kind of bullish on it.
Yeah.
So I think it's, I actually think it's emerging. It reflects part of the earlier conversation. When you say, well, what should the CIO focus on, and if the ERP is the burning platform? One of the things that I struggled with a lot as CIO was I tried to be relentlessly on message that the whole fabric of inquiry is changing, that technology is fueling new forms of discovery, new collaborations, new everything. And that worked just great until the ERP burped, or we had a new implementation of a color change on the student information system, you know, anything that changed, and suddenly the conversation was back on that. And I think that these positions are emerging in part to provide an institutional platform that can really focus and collaborate closely. So Laura Patterson, who, contrary to the program, I am not the CIO. Laura Patterson is the CIO at the University of Michigan. And we have each other on speed dial. I think 2 weeks ago, we spent literally every day together. And I think it's a way of providing some balance and perspective between the demands of the sort of utility, security-driven focus that in the end is daunting, and to provide this other focus on, well, so how does all this relate to the digital what's next?
I'm going to jump in here. I think some of this is also perhaps related to my fear of becoming Kodak. It's a way of saying, you are outside, you know, chief digital learning officer. You are outside of the structure. You can reimagine. You can be free to be disruptive give explicit permission, basically, for that person to go and innovate. Mm-hmm. And I think we've had a lot of discussions at BU about how to create that agile startup within or tangentially tied to the rest of the institution. And some of what I've been trying to figure out is how really to manage that relationship such that I'm providing strong support for that entity, but not getting in the way.
Can I just add maybe the small liberal arts college perspective, I would wager, is that we don't need another administrator at the senior level. Instead, what we need to focus on is a really strong and effective collaboration between the provost and the CIO and between the CIO and the president and right at that level. But I don't see much appetite for thinking, you know, what money we do have we want to put towards financial aid and the notion of a new level position at that level, I think, would be a hard sell.
So
at Wesleyan,
I of course have to kind of push back, okay, having one of those godless, mindless bureaucratic positions.
Yeah, me too, but we don't need more of us. That's all I'm saying.
So, but you gave as your answer, what's the thing that keeps you up at night?
Yeah.
And you said security.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that keeps me up at night is whether we're going to be relevant 15 years from now, whether higher education is going to get defined out from under us.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you balance two huge existential threats, one that's in your face day in, day out, and another that's out there looming?
Yeah, it's why the job is very interesting. I mean, I think they expect these things to be dealt with. Right,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, you just try to sleep soundly, get lots of mm-hmm. exercise, I'm not sure.
Live long. <huh?
laughs> Live long, yeah.
I don't know, I guess I've worked at now four institutions, and I've worked under some CIOs, I think, that would be threatened by that type of organization, and others, I think, that would welcome it, maybe for the wrong reason. They'd be glad to get rid of the academic technology arm of their organization. But I think it's an interesting trend, and I think it's a trend that we should watch and pay attention to and see, you know, it would be nice to see what happens in organizations like that. So those of you who are in those positions, we want to do a panel next year, okay? Is that all right, Malcolm? I got a yes. That'd be great. So let's look at some specific technologies and innovations. We said the name of this, I think we tagged on to the name of our panel, I think we put BYOD and cloud, so let's look at a few of those. We'll start with you, James, and we're going to ask, have you jumped on the MOOC bandwagon in any of your many positions?
So both at UVA and Michigan, they're both Coursera partners. Interestingly, I would say they're both Coursera partners for the same reasons. There was interest in the faculty and from the academic disciplines in experimenting with MOOCs. The barrier for getting into Coursera was very low.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it at both institutions see it as this great platform for experimenting. And I have to say, so before I was a CIO and all that, I was the undergraduate chair in the psych department for 9 years. So I have spent lots of times trying to get faculty engaged in conversations about teaching. And I have never seen faculty talk about teaching with a playfulness and an openness like the faculty who are teaching the MOOCs. And part of that may be because they're sort of the early adopters, but part of it is it challenges every assumption that they have. And so we're in it to learn. We're not in it because, you know, it's way too early, you know, in the MOOC, in the Gartner hype cycle, right? MOOCs a year ago were white hot. We're now in the trough of disillusionment, right?
Deep in the trough.
But something, I mean, I don't know that MOOCs are not going to live up to the hype that's around them, I don't think. But I do think that there is something really important that's changing. And part of it is this focus on how do you educate at scale And then how do you differentiate what you do not at scale?
It actually, the rush to judgment frustrates me, actually. It seems like it's more about grabbing a headline by making an outrageous statement about whether MOOCs are or aren't the next big thing or the best thing since sliced bread. When it's, you know, we joined edX last year. We're working on getting our first set of MOOCs up, but we've been in online learning for 10 years before that. We've been doing online learning a long time. But the MOOC phenomenon has engaged a sizable new constituency. Mm-hmm. If anything, arguably a core constituency among research institutions, I think, and excited researchers in new ways about what they can do with all this data that is exciting. And the desire to just make a headline with an outrageous statement about something being over, or it just started. It's not over yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I would echo what James said about the sort of buzz around campus about what we can learn about student learning from this mm-hmm. experiment. So we, you know, at Wesleyan, we've been involved in Coursera since the fall of 2012, and we've got 10 or so courses that have run so far. And it's just generated a lot of good conversation, both about how and why you might flip the classroom, what you can learn from discussion board activities that you can bring into your class, how to take your class of 20 students who are often from very similar backgrounds and expose them to ideas from all over the world. There's just a lot of really positive side effects from this exploration. So,
how many of you in your institutions are experimenting with MOOCs? Okay. How many are not? Okay, looks more not than yes?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting, because it seems like when you read on the news that everybody's doing a MOOC, it's good to hear. You mentioned online, Tracy, and let's just continue with that thought. How are you expanding your online learning programs at Boston University?
Well, we have a sizable set of graduate and professional online degree programs, and we are expanding, particularly in the last year or so, in social work and law, mm-hmm. And we're continuing to grow there. Mm-hmm. So we are bullish on it, mm-hmm. still to.
And how are you doing that? Are you doing it internally? Do you have partners?
We do it internally at this point. I think back in its origins, there was a partnership involved, but that was brought in-house many years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a self-sustaining group, part of our Office of Distance Education. But it is true that the last year's discussions of online learning, more broadly writ, have us thinking about what is the structure of that moving forward. Mm-hmm. And we really haven't made a decision there. We're still working with the structure we had in place 2 years ago. But we have created a separate organization for a digital learning initiative that is imagined in a more exploratory fashion, while our online degree programs, as well established as they are continuing to run along. And reconciling those two things is still sort of a pending effort that we don't think we've learned enough yet about what MOOCs will teach us or other experiments that we're running through seed grants on campus to really make structural changes yet.
David, James, anything to add to that about online programs?
We don't really do too much online at Wesleyan yet. But it's an area of growth, I think, for our continuing studies group, but it's a pretty small scale at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're looking at online, again, mostly at the graduate level, mostly in hybrids, mostly mm-hmm. how do you use technology to accelerate people through, but also as a primarily residential research university, mm-hmm. how do you leverage the advantage that physical place gives you? I don't think we're going to, I would be surprised if we move in a way of competing in a pure online space, mm-hmm. in part because that's commoditizing pretty quickly.
Yeah, I have to say at USC, we have embraced the master's degree program online, and we've grown exponentially and primarily with outside partners because we don't have an internal group. But we're now sort of stepping back and saying, we're paying them how much to do what? Can't we do that internally? So we're starting those discussions now. But it's still, as you said, we haven't quite figured it out. So it's an interesting discussion to have. Yesterday, our keynote speaker talked about how, oh, no, I guess it was Larry Johnson, the afternoon, spoke about bring your own device. He showed how all sectors, K-12, higher ed, museums, number one across. How are you handling it? David, do you want to start on this one?
Sure. Not well so far, I would say. You know, we certainly enable, first of all, we put the infrastructure in place to enable people to bring their own device. When you do that, and we also put instructions out there on how to connect your device to whatever service it is that you want. But the policies around security, for example, and around support for those devices, because they are so wide and so varied, we haven't really, haven't tackled that yet since arriving at Wesleyan. I think the infrastructure is the key.
Certainly the key to student satisfaction.
Yeah.
But to cite an older song than we started with, you know, anything goes. It is a struggle, particularly in academic medical centers. I think those of us with academic medical centers have taken perhaps some more aggressive steps to manage mobile devices for those who touch protected health information. But apart from that, for the rest of the institution, it's more about enabling folks to use what they want to use. And even in an ITIL-oriented service management type organization, a lot of best effort support to help people get connected and do what they want to do. And then sometimes looking at our applications through those lenses and going, oh my goodness, about how things look or don't look and perform, and the judgments of students and faculty now looking at our applications through the lens of looking at their consumer apps.
I remember I was on a professional panel with vendors one time on BYOD, and I kind of went in there and said, is there any other way? I mean, in higher education, it's like we never had a choice. It wasn't, you know, I think maybe many years ago, I remember when they said we couldn't have Macintoshes, and then people in closets still sat and used their Apples, you know, behind closed doors. So it's really hard to be able to do something like that. We're about halfway through our time, and I want to leave some time for questions. So I'm going to skip around a little bit. And James, when we were doing the planning for this, you shared a metaphor that I really liked. And it was, you said that an IT leader should be pitching rather than catching.
Catching rather than pitching.
Catching rather than pitching?
IT leaders need to catch, right?
Catch. Oh, I got it wrong.
Well... Keep going.
Okay. You never should use sport metaphors. I should have known that. So how do you move beyond the tactical and address the strategic? And how do you support innovation in your organization?
Yeah. So relentlessly on message about about the potential and the way. So pitch on message. But part of it was what I think is a struggle, and it goes to the BYOD piece, is IT organizations, we tend to think about what's the next great thing that we're going to roll out and build and deliver, and boy, they will come they'll just swarm us if we just get it. The next technology is going to solve all of our problems. And meanwhile, we're in this world where people actually, you know, they want their IT environment to be like their smartphone environment, a sort of secure framework, and they pick the applications that they want, and they move them around, and that's, I think, really hard. And so for IT organizations, I think it's really hard to switch from the producer push pitch model to how do you think about security and how do you think about investment when what you really have to do is catch whatever's sort of coming. You can pitch a few times, but most of the time you're going to be catching.
You hit that one out of the ballpark. So.
I really like this metaphor, maybe just because my son's a baseball player and a catcher. But when you think about it, so who's getting all the attention? The pitcher out on the mound, right? But the catcher is managing strategy. Catcher is making sure everybody knows where they're going on the field. Catcher is calling the pitches. Catcher is really sort of that invisible support underneath the whole team, letting that pitcher shine out there. And I think, you know, when we're really successful, we are that quiet strategist behind our provost president or faculty member out there pitching on the mound. And we're just making sure that it's all happening underneath.
You also have the best view of the field.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other side. David, along those same lines, how do you see the organization enabling innovation in the educational model in terms of academic technologies?
Well, so I think I'll turn back to exploration writ large, right? I think that the instructional technology role is to enable good ideas to be explored. Mm-hmm. And so in our case, if you look at the Coursera explorations, as I mentioned before, we don't really know what we're going to learn from them, but we want to learn what we can. And it is really sparking lots of conversations about different ways of teaching and different ways of approaching and actually measuring the effectiveness of any learning activity. So we're having lots of conversations now about, you know, we just did a 2-week winter session at Wesleyan for the first time. And there were lots of questions about whether or not you could learn anything in 2 weeks, and this is for credit. So courses that would have been offered during an entire semester were crunched into 2 weeks with some front loading of content and then taught all day, every day. So, and the experience from early reports was very positive, both from students and from the faculty. So that brings into question how we assess the learning outcomes in any situation, whether it's in a 2-week course or a 13-week course or an online course or those sorts of things. So I think just trying new things will sort of get you into a realm where you're going to learn a whole lot that you might not have expected.
Okay, good. I forgot to introduce myself, and I'm Susan Mitros, by the way, and I'm at the University of Southern California, and I serve as an associate CIO for Technology Enhanced Learning, an associate vice provost for educational technologies, and an associate dean of a new academy we're starting up. But there was a time about 7 years ago where I was actually an interim CIO, and I had been groomed for this position. I had a mentor, phenomenal mentor, 5 years worked with me. He left. I took the position, was in it for almost a year, and I hated it. The whole time I was in that position, I saw a student one time. And the time I saw it was because the student had pirated some music and we had to send him off to judicial affairs or something. But I said, it's a student. I get to talk to you. This is great. yet I really think that the CIOs that I know that have come up from the academic ranks, and there's many of them that have either come from faculty or have come from, you know, other academic IT professionals, are really good CIOs. So let's start with you, Tracy. What advice would you give academics, and particularly faculty or people in our audience here, teaching and learning professionals, that are considering becoming a CIO? Why would they want this job?
Why would they want this job? Well, that's a tough question. But I think the reason you might want this job would be if you really want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you take one for the team. As far as being able to do what you love on a daily basis, I think every CIO has had to give up something that was where they came from. But the opportunity to contribute at the institutional level and to empower the organization as a whole, mm-hmm. in the technology support area is significant. And if you really want to contribute at to the largest extent possible, and you see, if you have a vision, basically, for how you could transform that IT organization to make it more directly in service of the institution and the academic mission, then you've got a good reason. You kind of have to have that a burning desire to do that. Otherwise, all of the challenges of it are not really worth it. As far as how to potentially pursue that kind of vision, I think it really comes down to, if you have a vision, identify some projects that are part of that vision, put them out there, lead them, be willing to do the heavy lifting on it, and you will get the attention, either internally or externally or both, and you'll be asked to do more. At least that's my own experience and what I've seen happen with colleagues. Mm-hmm. People become leaders because they lead already.
David, James, anything you want to add to that?
I would pick up on the on the notion of this is a role in which you can be more effective than you could have been, you know, just trying to do something on your own. You know, I taught for a while, and I recognized early on that I would be more useful to the institution as a whole if I enabled fantastic teachers than if I just taught the stuff that I did at whatever level I was teaching at. And so, but the other thing, the thing that really keeps me re-energized is this is a very interesting and challenging position. So if you like challenging things and interesting things, it's hard to beat, because there are all the personnel issues involved in managing a large department. There are all the, again, people issues involved in creating collaborations with various people across campus. That's all very interesting work, and they're often really great people that you get to work with. So
you can make things happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes you make things happen and it's really painful. Sometimes you make things happen and it's truly great. But no matter what, you have the capacity to make things happen.
Okay. Let's do one more speed round before we open it up to the audience. So again, one breath. Tracy, we'll start with you. What do you predict is the next big thing on the teaching and learning horizon?
I think it is the platform that most successfully puts together social and analytics to make the learning experience as sticky and addictive as Facebook, eBay, etc., potentially including like the micro course in the age of Twitter, things that are condensed and create the incentives to persist.
Good set of lungs.
I would say that actually I'll go to the challenge side and say that it's how we determine what kind of credit we're going to give for various kinds of learning.
We make faith-based assessments and assertions about how special the educations we provide are. Those days are numbered.
Okay. So we have some time. I think we're going to be about 15 minutes now. You have to open it up for questions. Are there? Okay, Malcolm,
Yes, I have a question from the virtual audience. How are instructors at your institutions adapting to BYOD? Do you have support for them using various devices on campus, or how are you helping them cope with BYOD amongst their students?
I would say that at our campus, we actually, I think the faculty would say that they're still forcing students to consume their content in standardized ways. And so they're, so I don't get a lot of questions from faculty about why this doesn't look ideal on a mobile device yet. And we're trying to get ahead of that before that happens, but that may just be a reflection on the stranglehold we have over our course delivery mechanisms. I'm not sure.
We have a range of requests from faculties, often through seed grant proposals, for new mobile apps that are related to innovative ideas they're thinking about in teaching and learning. But as far as the sort of broad-based adoption perspective, I don't think that the pedagogy is really there yet, other than the desire to use phones for audience response type technologies, and we're certainly enabling that, not without challenges. But I think it's still, the substantive piece of it is still more about experimentation, and it's more the thought leaders among the faculty who are going there.
Okay. No, pass. I see a question back there.
So, Kyle Johnson, Chaminade University. Since we had some baseball analogies, I thought I would do a hockey one, which is Tracy had mentioned this idea that she gets a lot more support for things when the faculty or student wants it. But to my mind, that's a little bit of skating to where the puck is and not where the puck's going to be. So while that's important, sort of what strategies do you use to sort of balance that with the need to be looking beyond what anyone's thinking about wanting right now?
I think part of that is, you know, it's always more successful if when people bring things forward, it's their idea. But how it became their idea, there are a lot of ways to seed that. And on our campus, we've been trying to work at it through what's been actually a very long technology strategic planning process that started with providing our governance groups and community members with a bunch of what we called Spark articles and materials, not unlike the Horizon report. I think actually the Horizon report was one of them. Putting those materials out to faculty especially and encouraging them to think about these ideas as a seed to get the conversation going, but not saying, here's a new system I built for you, use it.
Anyone else?
Sure. So I think part of the challenge is in terms of trying to skate to where the puck is going to be and still not be in this producer push model, mm-hmm. right, is to focus on the really big things that you, I always think about it as things you ignore at your peril. So things we ignore at our peril, if we think that the cost pressure on higher education is going to go down over the next 10 years, I don't think that's going to happen. If we think about sort of what is all the hype from the MOOCs say, what does it mean if you are a residential, if you're a residential institution? What does it mean to be a residential institution in a digital age? You know, at some level, that's the same challenge I face in the library. What does it mean to be a physical place, a community bound together by some common commitments, and how do you have to think in that space, right? Cloud is all hype, scale isn't. If we don't solve problems at scale, we are in deep trouble. And I worry that if you move away from those really big sort of emergent shaping forces, you'll make little picks on where the puck's going to be, and you might be right on some little technology, you might be wrong. I'd rather let the community make those bets. And I think, you know, that part of the task is to focus on those big shaping forces, which are often terrifying.
Keep you up at night, right? Another question back there.
Yeah, the three of you on the platform are vice presidents and presumably report to your president as CIOs. So the question in there is, the other common reporting line for CIOs is either to a provost or to a CFO. So my question for you is, does the reporting line really matter? Especially in terms of your ability to engage with the teaching and learning mission of the institution.
And I guess I would add to that also having a seat at the table, of your executive table.
So I think that's critical, actually. And it was one of the reasons that I came to Wesleyan. And it's that simple, frankly, for me. If you're not at the table, then you're not able to sort of figure out where the other leaders of the institution are going and how to use the influence that you have in order to make IT a strategic and vital part of that direction.
I think it depends upon the context of the institution. Mm-hmm. I think there are situations where provost reporting can be as effective as presidential reporting, but certainly presidential reporting can be helpful for a situation where there are large-scale challenges in the administrative arena as well as large-scale challenges in the academic arena, because if the CIO position is aligned with one or the other will always think that they're structurally disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. So it is helpful to have presidential reporting when there are significant institutional challenges on both sides of the spectrum. In some cases, the administrative side may have been handled roughly 10 years ago and not in as burning a shape. And actually, I think in many AAU and other institutions, provostial reporting works well for the CIO. And at a time like this, that's also not a bad thing when there's a real clear focus on academic technology.
Who do each of you report to?
I report to the president.
Same here.
Isn't it?
So as dean and vice provost, I report to the provost. When I was CIO at Virginia, I started reporting to the COO, then it moved to the provost, then it moved to the president. It didn't make any difference to me. I mean, I had philosophical preferences, but which move that shape, but it was being at the table, and it was actually leading, right? It's not just being at the table. Mm-hmm. It's also not being afraid to engage, regardless of who your reporting line is. So when I first went to UVA, I reported to this chief operating officer, and the best piece of advice he gave was, he said, "You are a vice president and the chief information officer. Act like a vice president."
Good piece of advice.
It's a great piece of advice.
Mm-hmm. Malcolm, do you have a question from the virtual? Or
I do. This is a good one. It's kind of apropos of our speaker, our keynote speaker from yesterday. So here's the question. What is the role of schools of education or cognitive science in advising or working with IT at the leadership level?
We don't really have a school of education, so go ahead.
We do. Maybe we can talk about what it could be and what it sometimes is. I think in an ideal world, it would be a partnership of thought leadership as well as execution of pilot projects and having the research contribute to what is then done on a broader basis. I think depending upon the state of the school of education in your particular institution and the priorities of that school, they may or may not be either ready or interested in participating in that way. At BU, that's something we're still sorting out. I think our School of Education is prepared to contribute in many ways, but has not at this point been at the core of our online learning initiatives. That may change over time.
So I think it's a fascinating question.
Yeah.
I sort of think about, so imagine 15 or 20 years ago, somebody had said, so what should be the role of computer science and what you're doing, or engineering and what you're doing? So for us, the School of Education, the Dean of the School of Education and I talk often. They're thought leaders. But schools of education also sort of face the sort of prophets in their own land. I mean, I think that with all of the attention that's coming out now about active and engaged learning, if you're in the School of Education, you've got to be hitting your head on the wall saying, my God, we've been saying this for two decades. And now, you know, so I actually think you can either mourn that, or you can say, boy, now is a moment of opportunity to really start engaging broadly with faculty and the rest of campus.
Yeah, I have to say, I'll add a little bit to this because, you know, particularly with our faculty that are teaching online courses, without exception, they say after they've taught an online course and they've worked with an instructional technologist, they are better teachers because suddenly they understand learning objectives, they understand how to pace a course, they understand all the important things along those lines. And they hadn't been taught that before. You know, there's a dirty little secret in research-run institutions. Nobody teaches you how to teach. And when you teach online, you're taught how to teach. And our School of Education have been doing this, but we've never looked to them for that purpose. And I think there's a real opportunity that we should take advantage of. So I see a question here, and then I see one in the back.
As chief information officers, what is it that you want from your directors of academic technology? What type of relationship would you like?
Thought leadership. That's what I want. Thought leadership and the voice of the faculty, the ability to collaborate with faculty and inspire faculty. I want someone who has their fingers in all of what's emerging and the realm of possibility, who is also plugged into the rest of my organization and knows what we can enable and what we struggle with, but someone who has that, the light in their eyes of excitement to inspire others, as well as a vision to, again, where's the puck going to go, to the point made earlier. The person who's going to help me be out in front of that, because I can only be out in front of so many trends at once. I rely on that person to be out in front of where I need to be.
And tactically, I think that means coming to gatherings like this. So I really encourage all my director-level staff and their staffs, when possible, to get outside of the institution and see what's going on elsewhere and devote some significant part of your time to researching what is going on elsewhere. Because in addition to being the voice of our faculty, I want them to be the voice of movements overall that we can bring in and use to our advantage.
What they said.
I think we have time, maybe, let's see, for one more question. So
I'm going to pass because it was almost the same question. We're not all CIOs, so what are we supposed to do when we can't have a seat at the table?
I was just going to say, if we should have a very collaborative relationship, the CIO and the Director of Academic Technology, and if we do, then I should be an advocate for their point of view at the table that I sit at. That's pretty obvious, maybe.
So I had an employee come in the other day and was lobbying for a change in position title. And the argument was, I need this position so that I'll have authority. I need this so that I can be in a better leadership position. And it actually does sort of go back to the, I have biased preferences for, I think CIOs ought to report ideally to the president, second to the provost, third choice to the COO, CFO, and partly that's because the inherent tension drives towards the CFO. CFO's never going to forget about IT. Provost presidents sometimes do forget about it, so have this bias. But my response to my employee was, lead, right? Don't look to a position to give you the authority to lead. Start leading, and the positions will follow. And in fact, I aspire to an organization where really everybody in some domain takes leadership responsibility. Right? It's not possible in a university hierarchically to push everything down. You need people to be accountable and empowered, actually the other way around. Empowered, terribly abused word. I'm lobbying to bring it back. Empowered and accountable. And positions sort of come and go.
We're going to do one more speed round as our last hurrah up here. And the question is, I think we have a great opportunity here. You're hearing firsthand from CIOs how they feel, how they think, how they work with their organization. But one of the things there seems to be an issue with is how our CIOs communicate to their academic audiences or to the broader academic or university community. So again, one big breath. What's the best way? How do you communicate your organization's vision to your academic community? How do you dialogue with faculty? You're starting to take a breath?
One breath. Go to them.
Go to them.
We can have governance bodies that we have representative participation in. We can have community forums, etc. But there's nothing more successful than going to the department meeting, going to the school and college chairs meeting, having at least an annual meeting with each dean individually to talk about just their college, what they care about, their concerns, and their hopes. Going to them where they are and hearing their questions rather than asking them to come to something that you're going to put together or pay attention to what you have to say.
Okay. David, your one breath.
I agree with what Tracy said there, and I guess I would add that if you're going to do other things, diversify that portfolio, because different people consume information in different ways. And so, we all have websites, nobody reads them. We all have blogs, nobody reads those. We all send emails, nobody reads those. But somebody will read each one of those little things. And so you want to just try to do a shotgun approach.
Great. James, last breath, last word.
Relentlessly on message, don't confuse governance with actual alignment, and in a principled opportunistic way, always look for opportunities to collaborate, to find a common purpose around something you can do together.
Okay, well, on that note, I think we are finished. Let's thank our panelists.
Thank you.